Say something. Testing for the microphones.
On state loans, it's now 20 minutes after the hour, 5 o'clock, and it is the 27th of March. For the records, the committee members are Representative Ward, Representative Passenger, Representative Kopanen, and myself. And the first bill we're going to take up is HB 663. We do have a representative from the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, Mr. Lynch, on the line. We will take his testimony first, since he is under a time crunch, I'm sure, up there. Mike Lynch, please, will you come forward?
Mr. Chairman, this is Mike Lynch, Executive Director of Alaska Housing. Thank you for this opportunity to testify. It is my understanding that today we are testifying on the committee substitute for House Bill 663. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mike.
Mr. Chairman, as I understand it, the bill has been changed in two sections from the original. Section 1, which allowed the board to delegate authority to the executive director to sell bonds within restricted parameters, has been deleted. And while we felt that that would save some money, I guess we recognize that there must be some concern about control, and therefore we feel that there will not be a major problem in its deletion. We would like to have seen it gone the other way, but we can recognize the concern of the legislators, and we concur in the change. The second change, as we understand it, is the former Section 4, now Section 3, has been changed to tie the rate on what are called tax-exempt bonds under the Mortgage Subsidy Bond Tax Act to their own particular cost of funds, the tax-exempt cost of funds, as opposed to the taxable cost of funds as the bill was originally written. This change concerns us for several reasons. First, the budget which we have submitted, which as you know has been reduced from $105 million down ultimately to $16 million, was based on this change. And if this bill is approved as presently amended, or as the committee substitute is drawn, it will change our budget probably by as much as $20 million. Secondly, this would create this one loan. The purpose of the change was to put all loan programs on the same basis. All other loan programs of Alaska Housing have their rates tied to the tax exempt, to the taxable rates. That's true of the Veterans Loan Program. It's true of the Mobile Home Program as it's presently done with appropriated funds. And it's true of the taxable program, obviously. We see no justification for making this program different. In fact, it's been our understanding that when Rogers Ratchet was put in, the legislature made a conscious decision that they wished to only subsidize at the most 3%, and that was 3% less than the taxable rate, and that if Alaska Housing could demonstrate or find a way to achieve a cheaper cost of funds or lesser cost of funds, that savings would be passed, if you wish, back to the state in the form of reduced subsidy. What you're doing here is creating the possibility, probably the likelihood, of a higher cost of subsidy for these bonds because they will be tied to the tax-exempt cost. Frankly, putting it at 10% or 9% for veterans tied to the tax-exempt rate probably means that the first 90,000 will always be at 9 and 10. The time when tax-exempt costs get above 13% are fairly few. In realistic terms, it's entirely possible that as against the going taxable rate, these people could be achieving as much as a 6% subsidy in higher rate periods. And as I said, under Rogers Ratchet, it became pretty clear that the legislature had decided they wished to only subsidize 3% off the taxable rate. Finally, we think it's a rather dangerous precedent because we think that if you apply this logic here, you could apply it also to the veterans bond, which represent 50% of next year's program. And if the logic applies here, it applies there. And if you make that change, you're now talking about probably another $100 to $120 million of subsidy funds over and above the present budget. Lastly, I would like to make one other comment, and that is that since this bill was done, and as you know, it's an administration bill, the original one, done last summer, at which time it was not contemplated that we would be bonding mobile home loans. We now are going to be bonding them, and we have taken another look at all of our statutes, and we find that there is no place in the statute that really would address the question of a mobile home bond, either tax-exempt or taxable. And we need, therefore, we would like to suggest, A, we would like to ask that the committee consider going back to the original form of this this section of the bill, and secondly, that if they do go back to the original form, that on page 4, the section starting on line 2, starting with the word under, and reading through the rest of line 2 and the first two words on line 3 as amended, all of that be stricken.
Mike, what you're speaking of page 4?
Page 4 of the original bill.
The original bill should be underneath in your packet there.
Bottom of page 3 and continued on the top of page 4, at least the copy I have, Mr. Chairman. And in the second line, you have the last half of the word taxation, and then it starts to read, under the Mortgage Subsidy Bond Tax Act of 1980, parenthesis 26 U.S.C. 103A, parenthesis, comma, and then down on line 3 it says, as amended. We'd like to ask that you take out from the word, beginning with the word under, the balance of line 2 and the first two words as amended in line 3. In that way, we now currently, in accordance with our statute, set taxes, set trailer loan rates off of the taxable bond because the statute allows us to do that, but it says nothing about mobile home rates done with bonded funds. This would, since they will be tax-exempt bonds, this would allow us then to continue to set them off the taxable rate as we do now.
Run that change by me on page 4, line 4 again. And that's on the original bill.
On the original bill, on page 4, line 2, you have the half of taxation, T-I-O-N, at the beginning, and then the next word is under. And starting with that, reading across it, under the Mortgage Subsidy Bond Tax Act of 1980, parenthesis, 26 U.S.C. 103, big A, close parenthesis, comma, all that would be stricken. And then on line 3, the first two words, as amended, comma.
The reason for taking that out, Mike?
Because at the time this bill was drawn, there was no bonding of mobile home loans in Alaska, by Alaska Housing or anyone else for that matter, and no one had ever asked the question, well, what rate can we charge? We took a look at the statute, and the various statutes, not just this one section, but the others, and found that we really have no provision for setting the rate on tax-exempt mobile home bonds. The reason we don't is because the tax-exempt bonds we're going to do are not under the Mortgage Subsidy Bond Tax Act, and there is no place that we, in the statute, that we cover funds raised on tax-exempt bonds other than under the Mortgage Subsidy Bond Tax Act or qualified veterans bonds. The mobile home bonds will not be either. So by strict taking this out, what it means is that all proceeds from tax-exempt bonds will be have their loans set based on the taxable bond rate. I might add one more thing, Mr. Chairman. I'm sure there's a concern, or there may have been a concern about this, what would be a possibly an increase in rate to the first-time home buyer because these are our younger citizens. We have, as you know, opened up the HOP regulations, and there no longer is a gap. Therefore, anyone who, because of a slightly higher rate, could not qualify for a to pay the full rate on as a first-time home buyer would come under the HOP program. And could go all the way down to 6%. So this change should not cut anyone out of the program. The only thing that it will do will mean that some people will get a lesser subsidy, but those people can't afford to pay it.
Okay. Mike, what I'm going to request you do on 663 is send a written copy of any changes that you want to make to the bill and any amendments that you want to make to the committee substitute in writing. You can telecopy those over, and we will hold the bill over until such time that we receive those comments.
All right, Mr. Chairman, I'll be in Juneau tomorrow, so I will get it typed and delivered to your office tomorrow.
Okay, Representative Furness has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Perhaps a couple of questions to the chair. When we worked on 663 initially, it was my understanding that we supported, I know the board has supported, expanding the duties of the director to include the authority to go ahead and issue bonds, particularly those that have been supported by the board. The question to the chair is, who made that change in the bill, and why is it so changed?
I'm sorry, Representative Furness, I was consulting.
Let me rephrase, Mr. Chairman.
Sure.
Again, on page 1, line 16 through 21, it was my understanding that we had agreed, at least tentatively, there was no opposition to the expansion of duties of the director, of the exec director of the program, to include an authority to sell and issue bonds on behalf of the corporation. I note in the committee substitute that is absent. Who made the determination to take that out of the bill?
I made the determination. I did not realize. It was based on my feeling that that if we gave the executive director the sole responsibility, I believe the testimony from people in the committee indicates that that responsibility was a little bit too broad.
Mr. Chairman, as I recall, we had talked to at least Commissioner Heath, and he in turn supported that, and I have a great deal of respect for his judgment. I don't recall any of the other board members, committee members, objecting to that, particularly after the board had assured us that there were certain safeguards and that he would only be acting in a capacity that had been reviewed by the board. I guess I'm a little concerned that the chairman would unilaterally take something out without having the rest of the committee members also endorse that.
Well, I don't believe there was a vote that was taken specifically on leaving that specific section in. I didn't realize that you had a strong
I had understood us to support that. Again, based upon the testimony from Commissioner Heath, that they discussed this, those safeguards were there. It was a means of facilitating the operation of the program, and there appeared to be no objection. I'm a little concerned. The other question, Mr. Chairman, has to do with Section 4. The rationale for tying this into tax-exempt bonds as opposed to taxable obligations, what was the rationale for changing that section of the bill?
The rationale was that the format could be used if it was presently in statute, and that we were just duplicating that under the non-taxable.
I don't understand it, Mr. Chairman. As testified by Mr. Lynch, the way the other programs are handled, the rates are tied into the taxable bond cost as opposed to the tax-exempt bond cost. It appears that we would be setting up sort of a different handling of this particular program versus what they're doing on a normal condition with the rest of the program. And the concern is we ought to try and stay with uniformity where possible.
I think that's what we were attempting to do by making that change, was to make it uniform. Tax exempt and the taxable, is that correct?
They would be, under the old language, Representative Furness, they would be selling taxable, they would be selling tax exempt bonds and then charging the borrower an interest rate based on taxable issues, the rate that they sold taxable bonds for. And it was Representative Ewing's feeling that it was not proper for the interest rate to be charged to the borrower. That the interest rate that should be charged to the borrower should be based on what Alaska Housing Finance sold tax-exempt bonds for, not what they sold taxable bonds for. Under the old language, the rate that would be charged to the borrower would be the rate that taxable bonds were sold for, not the rate that tax-exempt bonds were sold for.
Mr. Chairman, let me just share with the chair and the probably committee. It's my recommendation that if you're going to make changes in the bill, then let the committee as a whole make a determination of the changes. Not simply propose to the committee a committee substitute with those changes already in there. The responsibility of this committee is to deliberate on these, and we should come to some type of conclusion on those. I guess I'm a little offended that this has happened, and I hope in the future it won't happen again.
Okay, well, I think that you can look at it as a working draft and look at it from that standpoint. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I certainly hope my colleague wouldn't be offended much longer. Mr. Lynch, is he on the thing now? And he's going to bring more detail in about the $20 million additional cost that he had made reference to. Is that correct?
We're going to need the backup information on the additional $20 million and your justification for that.
All right, Mr. Chairman. I'll bring that with me tomorrow also.
Thank you. Representative Passenger?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No.
Yeah? Come up.
No.
I think they see us as a workable bill.
I'm curious about the 20 million. Hmm?
We'll take the, we'll hold over 663. At this time, we'll take up 685. Okay, we now have 685 before us, and we have a committee substitute before us as a working draft. We'd ask all committee members to take a look at it.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Ward.
So then.
I'll leave it up to them. Let me just read it for a minute. Mr. Chairman, are we on teleconference?
No,
on 685?
We're off.
I'd ask that the bill be held over so that I can review it. I have had a chance to review it now, and do you have plans for witnesses to testify on it, or would you like to pass it out of committee, or what's your pleasure?
Why don't we work as it, why don't we adopt the committee substitute as a working draft, and then we can go from there. Why don't you make the motion?
Okay. I'd move that we adopt the committee substitute for purposes of today's business.
Any objection to that?
Great.
So ordered. So we do have a committee substitute for House Bill 685 before us. It's now before you. Would you like to work with the draft?
Yes, can somebody, so that I don't have to, to refresh my memory, the public members,
The public members, let me explain the changes that have occurred there. On the public members, the original bill on ARC was to change the public members to eliminate the public members. However, the Loans Committee substitute retains three of the public members and also names the Commissioner of Commerce and Economic Development to serve with the Commissioner of Revenue, who's designated as a chairman.
And what was it before?
And before, it actually curtailed the original five-member board and put it down to three members and set it up so that there was Department of the Commissioner of Revenue, Commissioner of Commerce and Economic Development, and one-third commissioner, which is...
Is the Commissioner of Revenue, I noticed, is here. Does he wish to speak to the committee substitute?
Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to, but I have not had an opportunity to meet
him. I haven't either.
You got a labor and commerce bill.
No, we didn't do that.
Terry Elder, did you want to speak on the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I'm similar to Commissioner Heath. I've just seen it. It's rather difficult. I could make one comment just offhand. My name is Terry Elder, Deputy Commissioner of Commerce and Economic Development, and with respect, at least to Section 6, which is the composition of the board, I could see a possible problem from the standpoint that the purpose of ARC isn't changed. That is, that it's to affect an orderly windup of its affairs. And it would seem to me that it may be difficult to find three public members who are essentially interested in winding up the affairs of the corporation. And if that's the case, Harold Diffner might be able to answer that better than I, but I'm just speculating. And if that's the case, it may be difficult to get a quorum, and that's two to quorum.
This essentially sets up five members on the board?
That's correct. The only difference between this and what it is currently is that there are four public members currently allowed for and one commissioner. And Carol Diffner worked fairly hard for some time last year trying to to fill. We have two vacant public member slots. She worked pretty hard trying to fill those and was unable to. And that was before we had legislation in to affect the orderly windup, and that may be a problem. The administration would still support the original. I think I can say that, Commissioner. The administration would still support the original bill that would have three commissioners. So
be the, and those would be Commissioner of Revenue, the Commissioner of Commerce, and Economic Development. What's the third commissioner?
And a third to be named.
Be named.
Named by who?
Actually, by the governor. Oh. Actually, I don't even think the Representative of Development was mentioned. Only the Commissioner of Revenue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is another case, too. I read this the other day. I felt that this language was acceptable, particularly in light of the commission that ARC is now phasing out. It says here, the board consists of the Commissioner of Revenue, who shall serve as its chairman, the commissioner, and two other principal executive departments, commissioner of two other executive departments designated by the governor, which appears to be a reasonable board. Now, I see we have here,
I think the concern of the chair was that we didn't want to leave the public members out of it if they had a legitimate concern. However, we are taking testimony from them.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, if I may continue. This is a wind-down situation. It doesn't appear that we ought to be encumbering public members. I would assume that the department would be basically charged with collecting those assets. Unless you can show us different where that's necessary, I would suggest we go back to the original language.
Commissioner Heat.
Mr. Chairman, for record, my name is Bob Heat, Commissioner of Revenue. And I just wonder if there's some perhaps confusion as to what we started out to thought we were doing here. And I think ARC was a sort of a noble experiment that failed for a number of reasons. It's a question of should a state ever be in the venture capital business. And from the record of ARC, I would think not. The assets that remain are some strange hodgepodges. They keep attorneys busy for a rather extended period. There are at least three chapters. We're involved in at least three Chapter 11s. And it's that type of assets we're dealing with. It's not real live ones. We own a fish bottom fishing plant on Kodiak that we may have a live one that might buy it. We'll lose money on that transaction, I'm sure. But it's those sorts of assets, and I just would question the need for public board members under this particular scenario. Now, if there were any move to resurrect this in some manner and make it an active entity, then yes, I think it would be an entirely different question. I might also suggest that we have a board member, a present board member of ARC with us, and he might have some comments on that. Mr. Green's here.
Did you want to cause all the trouble?
It's all my fault.
One year man.
I just wanted to get it on the record.
And your fault. For I could comment on that, Mr. Chairman.
Certainly. Then Representative Pesker's session.
Chairman, only I endorse what Commissioner Heath has said. It, as long as the principal purpose of this bill is to terminate ARC, there really isn't any point, I think, in putting public members on. I intend to finish. What had happened is the present public members are on there and were appointed in the last month or two of Hammond administration, and Governor Sheffield, when he came in, had asked the present board, which consists of public members of myself and Perry Eaton, are the only two public members left on the board, to put to hold the corporation really in abeyance. And we did not go out and seek any new investments or actively conduct the corporation in equity investments. And so it sat in a holding pattern until the governor decided what he wanted to do. And his decision has been made, and we're concurring with that. I think we'll probably be tendering resignations here before long, and I don't think you're going to find, if the corporation is being wound up, any public members that would either want to serve or could really add that much to what is really a liquidation function. So I can add my 2 cents worth there. I would, to protect the record, indicate that these investments were made by the trustees prior to the appointment of the board members. So we claim no responsibility for the portfolio, although it isn't quite as bad as it may seem. There were some success stories, and I'd commend to your reading a document that was done by Dean Olson, a former trustee, maybe partly self-defense since he was one of the trustees. But in any event, there was some good done, and it was a noble experiment, as Commissioner Heath pointed out, but there were some successes as well as some considerable failures.
Thank you. Representative Pascoe.
Well, I guess maybe I should be apologetic, though, Mr. Chairman. I didn't realize that the committee substitute altered the board. I thought we were basically in the same form as the original bill. And I suppose we could always rescind our adoption and go back to the original bill, but in the meantime, I'll just be quiet and listen to testimony.
Okay, I think what we will do is we will go back and with the consensus of the committee, take up and put in the original language in that particular section.
Mr. Chairman, could I also...
Well, what are the other changes, Mr. Chairman, in the committee substitute?
Go ahead.
Excuse me. Mr. Chairman, my name is Norman Staten, Special Assistant to Commissioner Heath, and I notice on page 3, line 20, section G, and section, on line 25, section I, don't know where that doesn't have anything to do with this legislation as it started, sir.
Yeah, what's that? Page 3 and page 4.
Page 3 and 4, you've got some other bill going on.
Yeah, but we're moving ahead.
You got some steam on you, too.
don't be confusing us with details.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, for the committee and for Mr. Staten, when the drafter put the Resources Corporation through the computer, they came up with several additional sections which needed to be deleted from the present statutes because they made reference to the corporation, and those are the sections that are included there.
Those are technical changes.
Yes, and there's also a repealer section that's additional to the ones that were in the original bill.
Then how did we get this board changed without the committee's knowledge?
The board was changed with the committee.
And I dismissed it.
I mean, well, the chairman brought this draft. This hasn't been finalized by anybody. It's a draft. It says that memo that it's draft and the writer's on it.
Okay.
But the technical changes in sections, I believe it's section 3 and 4, 2 and 3, are from the draft for revising.
We have a draft.
No, we don't. Mr. Asper was going to be here, but his wife is out of town, and we ran into a difficulty getting here at this point.
Mr. Chairman, if I may pose a question here. I'm reading page 3, line 25. So the commissioner may provide for the establishment of an exploration incentive credit system. Under that, a lessee of the state land drilling an exploration well on that land may earn credits, etc.
Okay, the only parts of that are changed are those that are in brackets, and where they change from which to that, and then at the end where they take a reference in the Alaska Renewable Resources Development Fund out. That's the only thing that's changed in that. There's two other minor things.
And those
making
are technical changes.
Changes from plural to singular and vice versa.
Well, why are we dealing with this at all? I still don't understand why we're dealing with
it. We're dealing with it because they're technical changes that the governor's bill did not pick up on originally. And those have to do with line 23, line 12 on page 4, and the Alaska Renewable Resources Fund had to be deleted.
So it was the opinion of the drafter that these were things that needed to be...
That were not caught originally in the governor's bill. It's not the first time we've seen...
If I may, talking to Mr. Clark, or Clark Green, he's pointing out that the Alaska Renewable Resource Development Fund was already repealed, and if that's what you're doing is clean up that through this vehicle,
yeah.
It makes sense that... ours was drafted by the Department of Law. Didn't see all those other cleaner uppers.
There is a difference of opinion between the Department of Law and the way that
let's make sure we understand what we're doing here.
Our only concern is that it doesn't, as long as everyone understands the technical cleanup amendments, it doesn't cloud the intent of the bill.
Okay. Okay, what we will do is hold the bill over and have the drafter look it over and come and testify before the committee, and then we can go with that. So we'll hold that over another day.
Chairman, I'd like to comment. I think I agree with the intent of the cleanup, because otherwise we'll have a statutory ghost of the corporation floating around.
Okay, at this time we will go and take up HB 574.
HB 574, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, we do have a committee substitute before us on House Bill 574. In discussions with Representative Furness and other people on the committee, there has been a new section that's been added which pertains to the reestablishment of the loan program for small businesses. Please refer to the new sectional analysis, which is marked in red on the first page for specific information on the bill. Section 20 specifically refers to the Small Business Development Loan Fund. Also, there are now four new fiscal notes which go along with that. We can go over that. One is for accounting and collections, one for data processing, one for investments, and one for the Office of Enterprise. Okay, we do have two people testify on this bill. Mr. Elder.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, for the record, Terry Elder, Deputy Commissioner of Commerce and Economic Development, and also present in the audience and available for any questions that you might have would be the directors of the various divisions that have submitted fiscal notes for this bill. The Willie Sykes, the Director of Enterprise, Paul Arnold, the Director of Investments, and Maggie Hamley, the Director of Accounting and Collections. Also, Henry Lancaster, should be. Yes, Henry Lancaster, the Governor's Office, is here to answer any questions and provide some input. We testified earlier on all the other sections of the House Bill 574, which is the market type interest rate. And unless there are some questions, I think Representative Pessinger may not have been here at that time, so I'll just, for his benefit, unless he's had a chance to read it, run very quickly over it. The bills essentially, the rest of the sections of the bill, essentially deal with the direct loan programs in our department, which are currently the last of the statutorily fixed interest rate programs in the state, and they remove the statutorily fixed rate and replace them with a formula that is tied to the U.S. Treasury rate. And so therefore, if the loan program makes a 10-year loan, the base rate is the 10-year treasury rate. If it makes a 20-year loan, the base rate is the 20-year treasury rate. To that base rate, and that base rate therefore moves over time as treasuries move over time. We get that information in a publication from the Federal Reserve. To that base rate, we add 125 basis points as a risk adjustment, because people obviously aren't of the same quality as the federal government. They don't run $200 billion deficits either. And to that, we also add 75 basis points for administrative fees, which on the theory that people who benefit from a program receive a direct benefit and therefore should pay for that benefit. And then from that we subtract a subsidy, which we put in 300 basis points, which is the current maximum subsidy allowed under Alaska Housing Finance. All that nets out to 1%, one percentage point below the U.S. Treasury rate. And we use this formula in order to isolate the policy elements of an interest rate that would be charged in a program between the adjustment for risk, the administrative fee, and the subsidy. And you can That way you can approach each particular policy element separately. So we're less concerned about the numbers that we started off with. We think we have reasons for recommending 125 and 75 and 300, but we're less concerned with the specific numbers than we are with the formula. In addition, the bill addresses the problem of dedicated funds by saying all income that's derived from a loan will go to the general fund. And the only thing that returns and is kept by the loan fund is the return of principal. And therefore, we essentially eliminate the question of dedicated funds. And therefore, we've also had to ask for, in this bill, some reappropriation for the loan programs, which currently we're assuming will receive some and keep some interest payments in fiscal 85. Well, if this bill passes, of course, we won't keep that interest, and therefore we have to appropriate some of the funds for the loan program. But that, in fact, is one of the strengths of returning all the income from the loan program to the general fund. It forces us to ask the legislature for any new funds that we think are needed, and you can determine whether or not you want to continue the program, expand it, or contract it. That was what was in the original bill, and that retains in this committee substitute. And we certainly continue to strongly support that approach. I could stop on that to see if there are any questions, particularly Representative Pessinger, since he wasn't here at the time.
Any questions on that section?
Terry, thank you very much for taking the time and for going over it with me. I appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative, okay, now that was on the first section. Now we do have a committee substitute before us.
And Mr. Chairman, as you mentioned, in the committee substitute, the primary difference is the section 20, which is on page 14, that essentially reopens the small business loan program. As you'll recall, the small business loan program that used to be in the Department of Commerce, which I believe was instituted in the early 70s and ran for about 10 years, was phased out in 1981 and transferred, the responsibility was transferred to ADA, the Alaska Industrial Development Authority, in their enterprise development fund. And that's the known probably generically as the SBA guaranteed loan purchase program. And therefore our program, which was was both a direct and indirect loan program, was essentially stopped by simply saying no more loans could be made after June 30, 1981. What this does is rewrite but reopen the small business loan program, and really aim it at small businesses by limiting the dollar amount to between $5,000 and $50,000. The previous program went up to $500,000. We have several objectives. One objective is to, of course, avoid competition with the private sector. We don't want to replace the banks as lenders, but we want to fill any gaps. And therefore, we think that if there are gaps to be filled, that those gaps are on the small end of the loan spectrum rather than the top end. And they're probably also related to collateral problems, people who have good ideas but don't have track records, etc. So therefore, we think we need a program that is flexible and is aimed at small businesses and at the small end of the spectrum. Consequently, this program would be limited to $5,000 to $50,000. With the maximum that any one borrower could owe to the fund is $50,000. So we think that by itself targets the smaller businesses. Also gives the department flexibility with respect to collateral, by saying the department may accept collateral. This means we could or we could not, and we probably want to do that by regulation. But the point is, the tighter you make it, the more collateral you require, et cetera, such as in some of our other loan programs that require 75 to 90% loan-to-value ratios and things like that, the tighter you make it, the more likely you are to be encroaching on a business that the private sector would satisfy anyway. We've put into this bill a requirement that the department make a determination that the borrower cannot receive private funds on a timely basis from the private sector. And we think that that, again, is an attempt not to replace the banks, but to supplement the banks. It's our intention to work very closely, because we felt very strongly in the past, and that's the reason that we have an Office of Enterprise. We felt very strongly that technical assistance for small business is critical, and is at least as critical as financial assistance. And consequently, we want to see a program here that, for the first time, really ties the two together in a formal way, so that the borrowers would actually approach the state through the technical assistance centers that we propose to be contractually tied to us through the Office of Enterprise. And that way, the borrower not only gets financial assistance, but also gets technical assistance, which we think will make the borrower a more sound business person and therefore a more sound risk over time.
Now, Mr. Elder, the technical assistance isn't taken into consideration here, is it?
The technical assistance is taken into consideration in the fiscal note that Willie Sykes, Director of Enterprise, is
given. You presently have that statute right now, so you can, it's just a matter of appropriation for you.
That's correct.
What do you expect the actual fiscal note on this to be?
The four fiscal notes in front of you reflect the entire bill. And the difference between that and the first one is would be the net difference. But I think in any event, if you look at the revenue that the bill is estimated to generate, it would offset the cost of the program.
So you're saying that that there's enough positive fiscal notes in this that there isn't going to be any cost to the new program?
Well, I'm simply saying that the combination of the increased interest received, the net interest received, will cover the cost of the operating cost over time.
So there's no additional amount that's needed to set?
We have, well, the fiscal note reflects that. I'm looking out at 1989. In the early years, it's possible. I didn't add that up, but in the early years, it's possible. The net revenue generated would be less, but by fiscal 89, certainly. Yeah, and it does require an appropriation, yes.
What would the appropriation be?
As indicated in the fiscal notes, Mr. Chairman. Where it says under funding, where it says general fund.
Under general fund, $10 million? That's the fiscal note from Mr. Arnold.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Recall that what that is we had over $4 million. extra $5 million reflects the initial capitalization for the loan program.
Okay, under the new program that you have, and I'll recognize a couple of numbers here, under this new program, the Small Business Development Revolving Loan Fund, how many loans would you expect to be gotten out on the street in the first fiscal year 85?
Mr. Chairman, that of course is always an estimate. I think that
Paul Arnold estimated 435.
We estimated 435.
And you don't foresee a need for a supplemental appropriation?
We don't foresee a need for anything other than what we've shown you in the fiscal year.
Which is $10 million.
That's correct.
Representative Passenger and Representative Wood.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Elder, I just wanted to have some understanding of the interest rate that would be charged under the Small Business Development Loan. Now, I'm looking at your United States Treasury rate, plus 125 points for risk, plus 75 points for administrative cost, minus 300 basis points for the state subsidized share. So I guess what I'm seeing is an average of the U.S. Treasury rate over the period of the loan, minus 100 basis points. And I was wondering on today's market if you could approximate what that interest rate would be then that you would be charging to the borrower.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, yes I can. It's in the sectional analysis. If you look at the sectional analysis on the very last page, where it says attachments to sectional analysis for committee substitute, the very last page. That shows you what the treasury bill rate is. In this particular case, it's a 10-year, the 10-year rate would apply. And so if you look all the way down, the rate to be used for March 84 would be 10.7%.
Okay, if I can continue, you move more quickly than I... Okay, you factored out the state subsidy then, haven't you?
That's correct.
Okay, so you're 10.7.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Warren.
On the section on page 15, section B, on page 15 anyway, it's got a, on line 3, it says a loan may not be made for farming, fishing, or mining. I think I know why it's there, but I'd like to have somebody tell me why it's there.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ward, the reason that's there is that there are programs that already cover farming, fishing, and mining. We have a mining loan fund. We also have a commercial fishing loan fund. And the Department of Natural Resources has the agricultural revolving loan fund.
Clams or shellfish. Does the fishing loan cover shellfish operations, clamming operations?
Mr. Chairman, our loan program has several sectors to it. The first sector and the main one is for limited entry permits. The second one, of course, is Section B. Does that include clams?
We seem to have a problem.
Probably.
No, it doesn't.
My guess, it probably does not.
What I'm saying is I don't want to hold the legislation up, but when you I like clams. I support clams. I do. And it came to my attention there's not a program within state government now to get clams out of the water, Mr. Chairman.
They're in the mud.
And I don't know about mining and farming, but I imagine there's also some areas in that we cross purposes too. I don't know. There must be something falling out because I seem to be getting words from people that they can't fit in under programs. What they are, I don't. Right now, to get a loan for a place or a passing line, it's impossible. You know, I mean, it just literally is from the state or anybody else. And I'm just hoping that we aren't saying, you know, this is a very large segment of people. Would this not be the purpose to pick up these holes that may be there? Because we can't know them all. You and I can't know them. We found one already, clams, or shellfish, or whatever we want to call it. and mine's just a very, very remote knowledge of it. I know it exists, but there's bound to be more. And whenever we put things in statute, a loan may not be made for farming, fishing, or mining, and we say, well, that's covered somewhere else, and it is, except for it isn't. And that's why. Go ahead.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Boyd, I think that your point's well taken. What I would suggest is that we would be drawing up regulations for this program anyway, which would require a definition of farming, fishing, and mining. And we can address that in regulations, which is an open process. And you know, your input would be certainly welcome into how we define what fishing is.
It's I would rather have whatever is available for loans define what it is instead of me having to think up each one. Whatever the fishing, whatever loans are out there for fishing, for mining, and for farming that are actually being loaned on, those should be excluded. But any others that are a sub of farming or sub of fishing should be included. And I would feel more comfortable if it's worded in there. I guess regulations is fine. I don't want to have to dream them up. I don't want to have to put input into it.
Mr. Representative Ward, I would suggest that a possible definition, in fact, could be loans that are available under the Agribarb Loan Fund, under the Commercial Fishing Loan Program, and under the Mining Loan Program. And then, by definition, anything not covered by those would be covered.
If I may, Mr. Chairman,
yes,
because there are farmers that don't feel that the current farming loan regulations are exactly up to par. And
are you suggesting a change in the bill?
I think I'm
suggesting to the committee, whatever they're.
Yeah, no, I'm trying to bring concern out that when they say we're not going to loan them, anybody do it farming, you know, because there's some existing there. There's some farmers that don't believe that they're even eligible for loans, and they're not getting them. They're businessmen.
Representative Passenger, then Representative Kaufman, and Representative Burns.
Mr. Elder, I think there's a feeling here that we don't want to hold up the legislation. And some of this is developed through conferring with Representative Furness, and I want to give him due regard. But, you know, when I've looked at a lot of agricultural loans, I see a lot of people coming in and asking that there be a moratorium placed on principal payments, or there be a moratorium placed on interest accruing. And I see it pop up in legislation, and I see it sort of becoming law. I'm wondering, frankly, if we have the ability to be as aggressive as lending officers have to be with banks. If a lending officer makes a bad loan and he does it again and again, it'll cost him his career. And I'm wondering if we as state employees have the hammer over our head to where we've got to make good loans. I wonder if we're going to look at these loans pretty carefully, if we're going to take good security, if we're going to take good borrowers, if we're going to enforce our security, if we're going to get into foreclosures. I'm seeing some, and it's, you know, and I'm new to this, but I'm seeing, you know, when people come into me and they say, well, here's a bill for a moratorium on interest, and here's a bill to put a moratorium on principal payments. And I can say, well, here's a, you know, I see this throughout all of our state loan programs, and I know I'm just philosophizing with you, but I guess I should ask a question. Do you think we have the capacity in state government to act as aggressive loan officers and make good loans?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Passenger, my answer would be yes. We certainly have the capacity to do a good job to manage the programs which are created in statute. There is always a different perception among citizens who are also borrowers as to what proper action a state should take. And there are people who would argue that the state should never take good collateral, or take collateral, let alone good, take collateral such as houses or anything, say, other than a limited entry permit, and where they wouldn't question a bank that's operating for profit of doing that. So those kinds of questions will never really be resolved. There are good people on both sides of that issue. But I think if the question is, can we run a program efficiently? Can we protect our interest as it's defined in statute and regulation? Can we make the best loans that's possible to be made? Can we have good people? Yes, I think we can.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
Representative Copeland.
Thank you. I have two questions. One, deals with the small business laws that are included in here. In the conversations that I've had with small businessmen, the particular loans that they're interested in are relatively short-term, essentially inventory and operating expense loans that turn over rapidly. Would this section actually allow you, or allow you through the banks, to handle those kinds of loans, since the tendency seems to be to have the longer-term, more stable payback period loans?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Fogelman, that's a good question. The reason that we liberally use the word "may" in the bill is to give us the flexibility to do both. You're quite correct that that often small business needs an inventory or a just essentially a working capital type of loan, which isn't the highest quality. In terms of collateralization, this would allow us to make that type of loan. It certainly would be a short-term loan. However, also small businesses have difficulty obtaining long-term funds, and so quite often, 10-year money just isn't available. Whereas banks can, banks typically lend for a lot less than that, for a lot short-term. And so this gives us some flexibility, but it's certainly the intention that working capital loans and things like that, which are difficult to get through banks, would be available through this program.
And thank you. And the other question, of course, deals with the basis of 574, which is to provide a rate from which we could calculate the degree of subsidy, but as we deal with this in the bill itself, we're essentially assuming a 3% average subsidy and applying it against all of the loans. Would it be appropriate at this point to calculate the subsidy, the, you might say, program-specific kinds of subsidies? For example, veterans loans, current rate is 9.5, and under this for 10 years it would be 10.3, we may decide that would it be appropriate, in fact, it's a question of the committee, would it be appropriate for us to specify that for veterans loan it would be 350 basis points, for child care it might be 350, for some of the others like bulk fuel, or residential energy conversation, which is about the same, it would be a wash. in other words, should we? I tend to feel that in some cases the variation is going to be sort of too abrupt, and we may. It may be more appropriate for us to make the actual change in the interest rate somewhat smaller by writing in the subsidy rate into the legislation that are approximately current. I think that some of them would be too many small points, but at least round them off to say 250 to 300, 350 in that range, instead of saying right across the board that they're all 300.
Mr. Chairman, if I could respond to that, just point out a couple of things. That first of all, the entire question is a very appropriate question. And is points out the strength of the approach, and that is that you really zero in then on what the subsidy should be. So I have no problem with that approach at all. I support it. I would point out that if you look in the past, some of the changes have been much more dramatic than this. At times when interest rates, the last major revision to interest rates, quite often had 7% rates going to 9.5, and so. Past legislatures certainly were willing to see the interest rates move by much more than what would be moving at this time. Also, I'd point out that unlike Alaska Housing Finance, we don't, in this bill, at least the draft that we're presenting to you, we don't suggest a floor. The subsidy doesn't go away. Whereas with Alaska Housing Finance, as you call the Rogers Ratchet, essentially, at interest rates below 10%, there is no subsidy. And so, while certainly, while the base rate currently is rising, and as long as that rises, the loan rate will rise. It's also possible and hopeful in the future that interest rates generally, the base rate, will fall. And if that happens, then it's very possible that the loan rate will be below what the current statutory rate is, especially where they're fairly close right now. And so we felt that by leaving out a floor, there was no particular reason to try to get it very, very close to make the difference, distinction between 300 and 350. I would have no objection, obviously, if the committee felt that for any particular program, that for social or economic reasons, you wanted to put in a different subsidy rate, that's fine. That's exactly what this bill is designed to do.
Perhaps they ought to put a floor at least at 3%.
Well, it's an implied. I mean, it's a ceiling on floor of 3%. We just felt that it was unlikely that Treasury rates would ever get down so low that we would have a negative interest rate.
Representative,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question to the chair. Page 4, line 20, makes reference to veteran loans. Also identifies this loan amount of $10,000 to be used for education, domestic housing, or personal purposes. Is this program currently active? And are there any funds for it?
Which line?
Page 4, line 20.
Is this a funded program at this time, Mr. Chairman? I'll defer to
Mr. Chairman. Representative Furness, the program is inactive in that new loans have not been made for at least a couple of years. There is money in the program, and it's our intention over the interim to consider rewriting the Veterans Loan Program, and with the idea of possibly reopening it, but we have to run that through the administration. So it's something that we would like to take a look at. The Veterans Loan Program, of course, is the oldest loan program in the state. I think it was started like in 1947 for World War II vets, and it's continued. It's been added on to over the years, and for quite some time it was the only. Until 1953, it was the only, then the Aggravating Loan Fund was created, but then for a long time, that was it. When other loan programs were started, in particular around 1980, then that loan program was considerably cut back to the point, particularly when Alaska Housing Finance was expanded and a veteran's discount was allowed in Alaska Housing Finance, that loan program was cut back. But to answer the question, yes, there is still some statutory authority on the books for some types of loans. But as I said, loans haven't been made for about 2 or 3 years, and we will work on that in the interim. And certainly appreciate any input that you might have.
And Mr. Chairman, I guess the concern is having this in the bill. This bill is available for public digestion. Could be misleading unless it is an intent to reactivate that. I call your attention to page 5, lines 1 through 8. Business loans not exceeding $125,000 that may be made to acquire, finance, or refinance of equipment businesses, including mining and fishing. So that covers Ripson and Ward's concern, at least that's there. But the question to the chair, is this an active program? Are the funds there at this time?
What's that for, mining and fishing?
Well, the $125,000 business loan.
Mr. Chairman, that doesn't include clams, shellfish.
I thought we had a pretty active program under that.
Mr. Chairman, the question still is, is this a funded program, an active program that is currently available to the general public?
I mean, mining and fishing?
No, Mr. Chairman, page 5, lines 1 through 6, makes reference to a business loan not to exceed $125,000, which can be used to acquire, finance, or refinance a business to include mining or fishing. Does not include farming. If the loan is applicant has got 3 or more years of general business experience. The question is this an active program currently?
Mr. Chairman, why?
I understand it's inactive.
Why
is it in this bill?
Is the rate of interest may not exceed 9.5%, so that's something we just added in?
That's been taken out.
Mr. Chairman,
I believe, this is to the best of my knowledge, but I think that there is a section in the statute in the footnotes that says that loans will not be made under the business loan section, so that statutorily what's allowed are multiple dwelling loans and personal loans, but not the business loans. And I believe we could, if you have statutes here, that would take.
Well, that's not important. Mr. Chairman, the important thing here, this is a bill that the general public can have an ability to review. And we say in this bill that there are minimum loans of $10,000 and business loans of $125,000. And this bill passes. My neighbor next door picks up this bill and reads this. They're going to want to know, where's the $10,000 veteran program? Where's the $125,000 general business loan program? If it doesn't exist, then we ought to take it out of the bill.
But, Mr. Chairman, I have one of these loans. It does exist.
They're not making loans under
it. I got it about 4 years ago. And I have one. I'm still making payments on it. Something must exist. They're taking my money and they call me.
Mr. Chairman, here, we're certainly servicing the current loans. If I may, what I would suggest is that we... it is our intention to work on this in the interim with the intention of reopening the program in a different way. At this time, since that would then be the only statutorily fixed loan program, we may as well change the interest rate at this time, work on the wording and the type of the description of the program on the interim, and then go forward with it in a comprehensive way.
But why was it included, I guess?
Because it is a loan program which technically is on the books.
I'm paying 7, I think, or 7.5.
The clear intent, as I said, in 1980 or so, when the other loan programs were expanded, and particularly the veterans discount rate was allowed in HFC, and most of these loans, most of the loans made under that program, not all certainly, but most of them were housing-related loans. It was fairly clear intent that, in fact, this program was to be essentially deactivated, in that the legislature changed the funding for the Division of Veterans Affairs to be only loan servicers and not loan examiners who would make new loans, and then finally put those into the Division of Business Loans and Commerce, called the Division of Loans and Veterans Affairs. So I think if we look at the actions as a totality, there was some fair indication in the previous legislature that the program was essentially be taken over by Alaska Housing Finance. And so what we're simply saying is that technically a couple of the sections of that bill were left on the books, and there are some funds that we think veterans can use if we in the interim work together to design a good program for veterans.
Thank you. So when this duties were transferred to HFC, then of course just the residential portion was transferred, because there is no business loans within there. So,
the suggestion was simply that obviously one alternative is to repeal the current veterans program, and you could consider that if you want to. I see no particular problem with keeping things the way they are and making the interest rate structure the same as other loan programs, in anticipation of simply reenacting a revised program in the next session. But that is obviously one alternative.
Yeah, I don't want to repeal it. I want to revive it, and I want the interest rate to stay where it is. Myself. Any
further comments? Thank you, Terry. Anybody else here to testify on this bill?
Mr. Arnold. Francis, come in. Did you want to testify?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Francis Galeo. I'm a business and financial consultant from Anchorage, currently under contract with Community Enterprise Development Corporation, and here on their behalf to testify in favor of reviving the small business loan program. Essentially, I wanted to make a few points. One is to simply point out the need for a loan program. I know that you've received testimony stating that there is no need for a state loan program and that commercial sources were satisfying all the needs for loans. And that's not true. And there are several holes out there, several deficiencies in available loan programs. Essentially, there's a large deficiency in the rural areas, the areas outside of Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, or even the areas outside of the regional centers of Nome, Kotzebue, Bethel, Barrow, etc. In 200 plus communities throughout the state, very few of them actually have a bank in the community. Banks in Anchorage and Fairbanks are disinclined to lend outside of the urban areas. There are several reasons for this, and some of them are very good reasons. It costs more to service a loan. The loan is more expensive. There could be a higher degree of risk. And the banks do not like to take collateral in rural areas. Additionally, the banks can lend all they want in the urban areas. Another area where there's a deficiency is in small loans to urban entrepreneurs who have or who do not have the classic capability of collateralizing 100 to 125% of the loan or do not have the track record that a banker can look at and gain a lot of comfort from. Usually the loans that these kinds of small businesses need, both the small urban business, the rural business, the urban contractor, $5,000 to $50,000, even all the way up to $100,000. There's been some testimony, I believe, to the effect that if the state were to go into a loan program, it would compete against private industry, the banks. This is not true. Essentially, you can aim your program at the entrepreneurs that the banks are not servicing. You can aim your program at the entrepreneurs who are turned down by NBA or UBA. If the banking industry says to you you're competing, your response should be, well, then you make the loans. But there's a tremendous number of businesses and potential businesses that simply can't get the loans through the normal sources. Additionally, if you reactivate a loan program and you are a direct lender, you are in fact helping banks, because when you loan to an entrepreneur, the entrepreneur takes that cash and opens a business account in a bank, in a commercial bank. The method of making loans is important, and I think you have a couple of alternatives before you. There was some mention of tech centers, and I think that you can take technical assistance centers and somehow wrap them into the loan program, where they are in fact helping generate loan packages to the state. You gain a couple of advantages there, including having had a process of eliminating some of the more risky and less doubtful loans. I'm a big supporter of small businesses. I've worked as a management consultant with both small businesses ranging from mom-and-pop shops to multi-million dollar corporations throughout the state of Alaska. As we found out in the United States, small businesses are the biggest employer. Small businesses are labor intensive, whereas large businesses, which look very attractive, they are attractive, and I think we should have more in Alaska, but large businesses are capital intensive. It's the small businesses that provide the major employment throughout the United States. I'd encourage you, when you're looking through the bill and the fiscal notes, to pass also the fiscal notes, because the fiscal notes that I've seen are extremely important to the success of the loan program. I don't think you're going to be able to have a loan program, an effective loan program, if you do not have, or if the division or the department does not have the wherewithal to make the loans, to service the loans, and to provide the technical assistance to the businesses that you make the loans to. Some mention was made just a moment ago by one of the members of the committee about working capital loans, and I feel the working capital loans, operating loans, inventory loans, and that type of loan, which is a short-term loan, not for the purchase of long-term assets, is a very important kind of loan for businesses to have, and it's one of the hardest kinds of money for a business to obtain. Working capital loans are the type of loans that banks historically do not like to make and rather see the individual entrepreneur generate from operations. The types of loans, I think you can divide them into several categories, at least two that I can think of off the top of my head. One we can call general working capital loans, and in that I would include working capital, operating capital, inventory loans, startup loans for or mobilization loans for contractors, any kind of short-term money. The other would simply be loans for existing or startup businesses to purchase assets with. If you had to divide, if you had to allocate dollars between these two types of loans, I would probably advocate a 40-60 split, with 40% going to the working capital loans and 60% going to other kinds of loans. On the subject of collateral, even though I find myself in the position of an advocate for a client when I present a loan package to a funding institution, I'm still somewhat of a conservative in that I believe collateral is an important part of the loan, and good collateral helps ensure that the entrepreneur is taking part of the risk on him or herself, and I think produces a better entrepreneurial relationship and produces a better loan. However, I wouldn't feel that you should tie yourself to a traditional 100% collateral requirement. If you did that, you would be excluding all those people who can't come up with a 100% collateral for a regular bank loan and are having difficulty as it is. Rather, I think I support the part of the legislation that is flexible as to collateral, and I think you can take several different kinds of collateral. A state contract for a contractor, I think, can be good collateral. For that matter, federal or private sector contracts should be good collateral for a working capital loan for a contractor. Inventory loans. I think you can take the inventory's collateral, and I think you can take the accounts receivables derived from that sale of that inventory as collateral. I think you can take the assets that are to be purchased with the loan proceeds. I think you can go for some personal collateral. I think you should take the person's, the entrepreneur's, personal guarantee as part of the collateral. However, I think you can go for less than 100%, and I would encourage you to leave that flexible and leave that up to regulations. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my testimony.
Representative Ward, Representative Pessinger, Representative Culpin.
Thank you. There's a portion in the bill here that says that we're considering under loan terms, and it says, a loan may be secured by acceptable collateral. For the purpose of this chapter, acceptable collateral includes the assignment of proceeds of a contract bid award. that language, I don't know what's wrong with me. I had this circle to ask a question of somebody along the way, Mr. Chairman. I'll talk to you about it. When I first read this, I thought, well, good, I will put in for a loan to be able to bid on large construction projects because there's enough front costs to be able to bid on them. It costs about $100,000 to $150,000 to put together the proper amount of documentation to build on a $100 million project in the state. You know, I mean, it just costs that much to actually get the documentation together to bid on it. Do you foresee this as a mechanism to bid on things?
Not for the size that you're that you.
Well, no, we have to smaller, but same theory.
Yes, I think the business that this is aimed at would be the subcontractor to somebody who's renovating a state building, and some small business has a subcontract to do the drywall, a $100,000 job, and in order to get started needs $25,000 in working capital to buy materials, maybe cover a couple of weeks of payroll or a month of payroll until that small business gets the first payment from the general contractor, of course, who has to get his payment from the state. So yes, it will enable more small contractors to work on state jobs, and it will enable them to bid. If they understand the mechanism of the loan program, and they know how long it will take them to get a loan through, and if the mechanism can be set up so that it's responsive to business persons' needs, especially contractors, then yes, this will enable them, in fact, to bid on jobs, knowing that they can get the working capital if they're successful.
I read it the same way, and I don't disagree with that. I don't know if this is to the chairman. I showed this to you a little bit ago. We have a disposal of property. The Department of the Department may dispose of property acquired through default or foreclosure. Disposal may be made by, and then it lists one and two. Number one says sale, either competitive or negotiated. I ask why we have negotiated in there. That bothers me because I think I would bid, understanding the system, to get collateral to bid on a project, and I wonder why negotiated is in there at all for disposal of property when we have going to a very lengthy public radio spot, publications, and different things. Is this a financing mechanism? Why would they have a negotiation of disposing of property through this disposal of foreclosure? The gentleman behind it thinks that answer. Yes.
I can answer that. All our repossessed property, for the most part, as a result of foreclosure, go into some type of sale. And if the property is a result of a sale, you have a market tested result for the sale. There are times when you, for example, just no one bids. So you might have one bidder, so in essence you would then enter into a negotiation to see if you come up with a price with one individual. So you might negotiate a price. Or it might be that the sale is conditioned upon certain terms being met. Maybe the bidder will take the property as is if the price is reduced, but they won't reduce the price and they want certain improvements made. So you kind of go into a give and take type.
So this and most other things that you've seen?
Yes.
It is.
In the past where we've been able to do that, that's correct. The reason we're putting it into the bill like this is that the Department of Law says that we really don't have the authority as we to, as far as disposing of properties in terms of financing, for example. So this is one case we're putting in. We're also in another bill doing the same thing with commercial fishing for it.
The word bothers me. I don't know why it does. I just can't. I think you spoke to it before. I'm one of them people that I feel funny about the state taking somebody's property, although I wouldn't feel funny about a commercial bank taking it. And I feel even funnier somebody negotiating that asset away to my competitor. You know, just like, insult to injury or something. I don't know. I feel funny about it.
Mr. Chairman, perhaps in response to Representative Ward's question, it is generally customary that if you can't sell it for a fair market value, you get a bidder on it. But you do try and dispose of it in some way, in that the state is not in the business of holding collateral of any type. It's in the business of loaning monies and liquidating that at the best of their ability. What normally happens in a situation like that is you will sell it either through competitive bid or through some negotiated arrangement, and the borrower is responsible for any deficiency balance. It's an acceptable means. Probably the uncomfortable thing is the state, particularly in our socialistic system, can be put in a bad posture when it has to go out and foreclose on a business, can't find a buyer for those widgets, must negotiate at a penny on the dollar. So, that's facts.
Representative Cassidy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Galea, you'd made the point about the importance of the fiscal notes, and I've just been spending my time reviewing them, and I think I finally got them digested. And I know you're not you're in private business. I was going to ask your opinion on these fiscal notes, but I just say it's good to see you, and I reviewed them all. And generally, we don't pass things from committee without the applicable fiscal note. I sometimes find an interesting relationship between the operating cost and the amount actually available for the program, but nevertheless, there's a lot that goes into this, and I've found fiscal notes to bounce all over. Some I find very, very, very precise. I think actually these are fairly reasonable fiscal notes, really, as far as what's going into it. Just generalizing. What I'm trying to say is I've answered my own question. Thank you.
Representative Ward.
Yes, I'd like to hear. The one part about the year near the year residency and a year's residency to assume the loan, are we talking about a year's residency in that business or a year's occupation, just living in the state a year?
I think it's just
why do we have that? Is that because that's what the Attorney General said is our residency now, or a defendable residency, undefendable, we just picked a number?
Sure.
Mr. Chairman, with respect to that, The Attorney General's office tells us that 1 year is defensible in a program, for one thing, but that any residency requirement has to be, in terms of its constitutional test, and I'm a lawyer, I'm told, that it has to be somehow reasonably related to the function of the program. And I think in this particular case where there is a subsidy in the